Hey gang, this episode is brought to you by Means TV, the world's first anti-capitalist streaming service. Stick around after the episode to learn a bit more about Means and to snag a nice little discount as a thank you for supporting my channel.
Venezuela is bracing for more protests today after Sunday's presidential elections.
Earlier this year, Venezuela had a pretty major election. On July 28th, over 10 million people went to the polls in a contest to decide whether to elect the incumbent, Nicolas Maduro, the challenger, Edmundo González, or one of the eight other opposition candidates. And then we saw a very familiar scene.
Of course, the accusations of fraud.
We say victory in quotation marks.
Electoral authorities, which are heavily controlled by the government.
Authoritarian President Nicolas Maduro.
Evil criminal dictator that he is.
Clinging on to power.
Undemocratic attempt to repress political participation.
It was clear from the start this would not be a free or fair election.
Western media has a particular way of talking about foreign elections, and let's call them attempted leadership changes in other countries. And in this video, I want to really zoom in on that. I want to dig deep into the story of foreign elections were served here in the US, and how that reporting affects the way we understand the world outside our borders, specifically when it comes to the reporting of our most important outlet, the New York Times.
So the New York Times is an extremely important newspaper, not only because of its huge circulation, but also because of its massive influence on other media. Its tagline is "All the news that's fit to print," and it really serves as a first draft of history for the American establishment.
This is Alan McLeod, senior staff writer at Mint Press News and the author of this great book on how media in the West covers Venezuela.
It's seen as an authoritative source, in fact, so authoritative that newsrooms across the country are faxed a front copy of the New York Times every day so that that can actually focus and influence its own reporting. We could probably say that it's the most important newspaper still running.
Now, I want to talk about Alan's checklist. See, when covering a coup, or an attempted coup, on a foreign leader that the US has designated an unofficial official enemy, articles in the New York Times and other Western papers tend to follow a pretty consistent checklist. Blame all economic and political problems on the government. Ignore the effect of any US sanctions. Constantly present the targeted leader as a tyrannical autocrat crushing dissent, no matter what the reality is. Refrain from using the word coup. Prefer instead words like uprising, revolt, or transition. Express ridicule at the idea that the US could be involved in the affair. Depict the new US-backed rulers as democratically minded and downplay any violence they commit in establishing their rule. And finally, blame the deposed leaders for their own overthrow. And you can really see this when you look back through the archives. Like back when the New York Times covered the US-supported military coup d'etat against Eduardo Goulart. In Brazil, back in 1964, the center-left president was overthrown and replaced by Ranieri Mazzilli, the first in a 20-year-long series of military dictators. The New York Times presented it like this. "We do not lament the passing of a leader who had proved so incompetent and so irresponsible. Inflation and a gradual deflation. When it came to the test, he had almost no supporters. Another peaceful revolution. Ranieri Mazzilli is just that and nothing more, an able, patriotic citizen holding the helm of the ship until an elected president can take over. Nation appears to have been yearning for a political cleanup of extremists. Widespread feeling of deep relief and optimism. There's a considerable amount of friendship for the United States, based on mutual democratic beliefs, social informality, and unbounding faith in the national future." Or take Chile in 1973. On September 11th, Salvador Allende, a democratically elected socialist, was overthrown in a military coup by the fascist neoliberal military officer Augusto Pinochet with support from the CIA. Allende had been elected on a plan to nationalize Chile's resources, like its copper mines, then owned by American companies, and used that revenue for improved social welfare and the start of a socialist economy. Here's how the New York Times covered his election. Calling Allende a threat to freedom and criticizing in a dramatic tone a tax raid on the newspaper El Mercurio, one of the most highly respected newspapers in South America. In reality, it was a pro-American, right-wing newspaper funded by the CIA and Nixon himself, according to FOIA documents we only saw 45 years later. And when the US-backed coup deposed Allende, the Times ran this article, denying any US involvement, ignoring Nixon's brutal sanctions, his famous attempt to, quote, make the economy scream, and instead, dutifully checking off most of our trusty checklist. And we can go back even further. Take Iran in 1953. 2 years earlier, Mohammad Mossadegh, a democratically chosen member of parliament, was elected prime minister. His first move was nationalizing the Anglo-Persian Oil Company after 50 years of colonial extraction that generated £115 million in earnings for its British owners and £175 million for the British government. The British responded by imposing a global boycott on Iranian oil, a naval blockade, and essentially tanked the country's economy into submitting back into Western colonial subjugation. The US was a British ally, scared of the socialist direction Mossadegh's policies were taking, and very interested in getting Iran's oil. So, in 1953, it financed anti-Mossadegh media in the country, carefully orchestrated a coup, installed the Shah, and in the process, gained ownership of 40% of the APOC for US companies. Meanwhile, the Shah continued to transform the Iranian economy along capitalist lines and became ever more brutal in his use of state violence, creating a secret police force called the Savak and abolishing the multi-party system that had been in place under Mossadegh. Now, here's how all of that was reported on by the Times. Mossadegh was painted as a Hitler-esque dictator responsible for wrecking the economy. The British came out pretty much blameless. Nationalization was framed as just a populist power grab, and the US's intervention is shown as merely an accusation by the Soviet propaganda media. That last story, by the way, quotes a CIA operative, General Schwarzkopf, declining to comment on the coup because, according to him, he had been out of touch with Iranian politics for too long a period. But we have declassified CIA files now, and surprise, he was orchestrating a coup with the Shah just 18 days before the Times ran that article. But I know, these could all technically be cherry-picked examples. Thankfully, we have some good data to back this stuff up. In an analysis of about 300 New York Times articles about Iran published between 1950 and 1960, both op-eds and editorials, these researchers found everything I just mentioned happened hundreds of times. The British blockade is never questioned, unlike Iran's nationalization policy, which is heavily scrutinized and disparaged as a facade for autocratic power. The sanctions are always presented as a scapegoat for the Iranian economy's problems, and the Shah gets consistently glowing reviews even amid some of the most brutal crackdowns. Actually, glowing reviews doesn't quite cover it. In an insane article from 1956, he's described as a dark, handsome man with searching eyes and a quiet, rhythmical voice. By temperament, he is calm and unruffled. By inclination, he is a philosopher, given to musing over the problems of his ancient land. Mossadegh is, quote, internationally famous for his bizarre habits, receiving diplomatic visitors in bed, weeping profusely and fainting in public, bounding upstairs like a rabbit? And, okay, they don't just do this with Iran, by the way. Back in 1984, deep into the Pinochet dictatorship and its political purges and crushing neoliberal inequality, the Times was still glazing him up as a, quote, lover of liberty, whose 68 years are belied by his boxer's physique, matched by a trim gray mustache. Pinochet was never described as a dictator, always as a Chilean president and Chile's leader. To remind you, Allende was, quote, a threat to freedom, leading, quote, a government dominated by Marxists. Left-of-center politicians are always described like this. Self-interested, power-hungry dictators. They're always exploiting grievances, grabbing power, or taking advantage of turmoil. A leader elected from a platform that hurts American business interests abroad is almost always self-interested somehow, even as they bring in the most pro-social policies their countries have ever seen. Meanwhile, the right-wing stooges that replace them sail in on unacknowledged violence, a promise of a pure commitment to democratic ideals, and a reassurance for Western audiences that they really represent the interests of the people. And then they'll inevitably reproduce the same pattern of brutal crackdowns, impoverishing the working class, and enriching capitalists domestically and abroad. The Times never cares to explain why these left-of-center, power-hungry dictators choose their progressive strategy and why their right-wing opposition doesn't. nor why the economy hurts workers so badly when sanctions are lifted and the capital flight stops. Once the coup succeeds, all of that gets filed under the "we got rid of the dictator" header and promptly ignored. But let's come back to Venezuela. Venezuela in the late 90s was not doing too well. After the global oil bust and the recession of the 80s, Venezuela was one of the many countries in the global south targeted by the IMF and its infamous structural adjustment programs. The country privatized many of its state-run corporations, sold them to international capital, reduced the government's regulatory power, and opened up trade to devastating international competition. It's in part thanks to these measures, imposed on Venezuela by US-led organizations, that the country's GDP fell over 40% between the 80s and 90s. By 1994, the banking sector had collapsed, inflation was high, foreign debt repayments ate up the government budget, and oil prices were falling. The government was useless, to the point that even Foreign Affairs magazine could admit it. And the institutions were so thoroughly rigged against the workers that when oil prices did start to recover, it didn't mean much for Venezuelans. 15% of the country's GDP transferred from the hands of workers to the hands of capitalists, and the real wage of an average Venezuelan was cut in half over 20 years. This is the context in which Venezuelans elected Hugo Chavez, who almost immediately started implementing changes to the Venezuelan economy that drastically improved life for millions. Revenues from the PDVSA, $12 billion from Venezuela's national oil company and the country's main source of income, were steered towards social spending programs in health, education, and food subsidies. The minimum wage was increased, and the percent of the population living on less than $1 per day fell from 14% in 1998 to 3.5% in 2006. Unemployment, which stood at 15% in 1999, fell to 9% in 2007. Petroleum, communications, electricity, cement, and steel were all nationalized. Illiteracy was eradicated. The student population grew to become the fourth largest in the world. Venezuela gave unqualified support for Palestinian liberation and gave its oil away for free to poor countries and communities, including Black and Native American populations in the US who had their homes heated for free or at heavily discounted rates, courtesy of the Venezuelan government. Venezuela stood up to Western countries and their companies and transformed their domestic policy to radically improve the average Venezuelan's life in what was once considered the worst-off country in Latin America. But these are not the policies that make Uncle Sam happy. So in 2002, when yet another US-backed coup briefly removed Chavez from power, the pages of the New York Times looked like this. Here we see all the same tropes on display. Chavez's presidency was repeatedly attacked as incompetent, unpopular, and downright dictatorial over the years. To remind you, Chavez won multiple elections under intense scrutiny from international observers that received the EU seal of approval. His party won a 2000 election in the National Assembly. He passed a recall vote in 2004 with over 59% of the vote, and even submitted his ability to run again for a third term to a national referendum. For context, countries like the UK and Canada have no term limits. Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair both served three terms without there ever being any accusations of a lack of democracy in the UK. And I think I need to mention something. Venezuelan elections typically take place with an incredibly high standard for legitimacy. One that's not only scrutinized by far more election observers than anywhere else in the world, but is much more advanced and demanding than what we have here in countries like the US. Since 1998, in order to vote in Venezuela, you need your national ID and your fingerprint scanned. If they both match what's in the national database, you then vote on a touchscreen voting machine. That vote is sent to the National Electoral Commission headquarters in Caracas, and a paper ballot gets printed for you to put in a box. Then you need to put your thumb on an ink blot and stamp it next to your name on an electoral roll, and then you physically sign your name beside the fingerprint. Those results get sent to the head office in Caracas and double-checked with the paper ballots. Those paper ballots are counted in front of representatives from the community and the different political parties, and if there is no 100% match between the digital and the paper, that launches an audit. Alright, so that's a lot. Anyway, in 2013, an audit of the votes in the first presidential election that Maduro won did take place, and it found the results to be 99.98% accurate. That 0.02% discrepancy, by the way, only existed because 22 voters hadn't put their paper ballot in the box after the machine recorded their digital vote. Electoral processes like these are unlike anything we have here, and are part of the reason why Venezuelans' confidence in democracy has shot way up between 1997 and 2013.
Venezuela is one of the most heavily monitored elections in the world. There were over 900 foreign observers there, including from the United Nations and other big organizations. The response I got from those officials ranged anything from indifference to acceptance or friendliness. As I said, I visited 5 stations. Everything seemed to be working completely normal. When I spoke to the officials there, the words they mostly use were calm, tranquil, and fluid to describe the process. Been dozens of elections in Venezuela over the last 25 years. It's one of the most election-crazy countries in the world. And every single time the opposition loses in Venezuela, which is most of the time, the New York Times cries fraud and says that there has been some sort of great deception and manipulation going on. However, every time they have claimed this and it has been looked into, the evidence simply isn't there.
So why does the New York Times' reporting so consistently push the same line of a dictatorial regime from 1999 to today?
So there are a number of filters that really influence the reporting of New York Times and other corporate media outlets. To begin with, it is owned by a billionaire family, and that really has a lot of effect on the output. Ultimately, news organizations are reflections of their ownership. And they're also reflections of the advertisers who actually pay to have the newspaper printed or to have the TV run in the first place. And who advertises in the New York Times is multi-billion dollar corporations. And both the ownership and the advertisers are very keen to make sure that their point of view and their interests are promoted and not challenged. A third factor in this is sourcing. The New York Times has this culture of objectivity, which means you have to go to official sources and not question what they say. Ultimately, it is owned by a billionaire family, the Sulzberger clan, who have worked for decades alongside the CIA as Operation Mockingbird and the Church Committee revealed. We also know that the New York Times continues to this day to send stories to the CIA and the national security community in general to be edited before publication. There's also the case that if you do put your head above the parapet, there are organized groups who will certainly come at you with a lot of flack. Finally, if you are a foreign news reporter, it's very important to understand that these people are parachuted into countries they often don't really understand. Sometimes they don't speak the language. In the case I'm most familiar with, Venezuela, I know that New York Times reporters are flown into Caracas, live in the wealthy eastern parts of the city. Often they live in gated communities surrounded by armed guards. And so ultimately, everybody they interact with are members of the elite. And when you are talking with millionaires constantly, they have a very particular view of socialism and social movements. And that is not going to be positive. And we can see that coming out in their reporting.
And look, the point of this long rant is not to pretend like any of these leaders are unwavering defenders of democracy with an unblemished record. They're politicians. They're going to suck sometimes. The point is that these left-of-center leaders are paragons of democratic ideals compared to the tall, dark, and handsome right-wing fascist puppets that they replace or are replaced by. But they're presented as anything but in the Western press. All the while, the violence of the US, its greed, its sanctions, its coups, and its hand-picked dictators armed to the teeth with American weapons get swept under the rug, only to be magically discovered 20 years later in declassified documents. The alternative to the American empire is constantly presented as a dangerous, immoral threat, slowly justifying in the mind of millions of Americans the idea that something should be done, that if something were to happen, and if the US were maybe involved, that would be okay. It wouldn't. No country deserves to live or die by decree of American corporations. As I mentioned at the beginning of the video, you can now find Second Thought on Means TV, the home for worker-owned entertainment. I've been working with the team to bring on a bunch more creators, so stay tuned for some exciting new additions to the roster. If you're not already familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos, to original series like Means Morning News, to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. As you all know, socialist creators have to walk a fine line here on YouTube. We're always having to contend with age restriction, demonetization, and outright suppression, which for some reason, right-wing outlets never have to deal with. But now with Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means TV gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and their fans right on the platform. And the best part is, Means TV is ideologically dedicated to supporting principled socialist content. As a little thank you for watching my channel, if you sign up with my link, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you just $88, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using my link is directly contributing to the financial stability of my channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Both Second Thought and Means TV are entirely grassroots funded, and they always will be. So if you'd like to help support my work, consider signing up for Means TV using my link. It really does help me and dozens of principled socialist creators all across the platform. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.